Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
Thank you very much, and thank you for that warm introduction. This is a strange time we're living in, and it's a strange medium that we are using now. I'm still struggling to accustom myself to it. This is my second attempt, and the strangeness has something to do with the subject of my talk this evening. The strangeness of talking to people who are very much absent. They're not together, and they're not together with me. That is, the normal teaching situation is broken up in many ways. And yet, there's a strange way in which we are together in our absence. And that's a very abstract way of putting it. But now what I want to do is think about the life of Moses. And particularly through the prism of a passage in a letter by Kafka, which gave me the title for my book on Moses, Moses, A Human Life, not the human life, not the only human life, but a human life. It's a very modest claim about Moses. And I want to read to you the essential passage from that letter of Kafka by way of introducing my subject. The central sentence really is, Moses fails to enter Canaan, the land of Canaan, not because his life is too short, but because it is a human life. That is, and I'll read one or two more sentences that come before this. He is on the track of Canaan all his life. What an interesting way of putting it. It's as if that desire to enter the land, which comes out so clearly at the end of his life, when he begs God to let him, in spite of everything, lead the people into the land of Canaan, that desire has really been with him all his life. He's on the track. Somewhere unconsciously, that's where he's been going all his life. And this only shows, Kafka says then, how incomplete a moment is a human life. That a whole human life is an incomplete and unwhole thing. That there is something, that's his idea of what a human life is. That's the one thing that Moses has in common with all other human beings. It's the basic thing. That's what constitutes a human life. The fact that he could see the land only on the verge of death teaches you, shows you again that a life could last forever and still be nothing but a moment. That it wouldn't include necessarily the completion of life. That is, that one wants something all one's life, and what shows that it is a human life is that one doesn't actually get it, that one doesn't achieve one's desire. Now, that sounds bleak, to put it mildly. You know, that is, it's not a happy way of thinking of things. But I want to try to show that there's something deeply Jewish about it and not entirely pessimistic. That there is something that goes together with that feeling of incompleteness. What is the gain? I can start by plunging right into the heart of it. The gain of a life that's incomplete is that it's a life of desire. That one is always looking for something. That one is never complacent. That one can never sit back on one's laurels. And being in the midst of desire, living a life of desire, is a way of really living. That is a human life. Now, that's very abstract, and I'm certainly not going to stay with that abstraction. What I want to do this noontime for many of you, and this evening for those of us in Israel, what I want to do is to look at that moment in which Moses prays most poignantly to God to let him cross over the river and enter the Holy Land. And God rather harshly refuses him. That's my starting point. We're starting at the end of Moses' life in Sefer Dvarim, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 3. Chapter 3 of Deuteronomy, that means this is the book, Ele HaDvarim Asher Diber Moshe. The book of Deuteronomy, the book of Dvarim, begins with the sentence, these are the words that Moses spoke across the river from the land of Israel, Be'ever HaYarden, in that position of not having achieved his desire, Be'ever HaYarden, on the other side of the Jordan River. And these are the words, basically, the whole of Book of Deuteronomy, or at least, technically speaking, about a half or a third of the Book of Deuteronomy, is Moses' speeches, his last speeches to his people. And most personal among those speeches is this one that I want to look at with you now. I didn't put it on the source page. I'm going to read it now from my text, but from the Book of Deuteronomy. I think you'll be able to follow without the visual in this case. The passage begins, it's the beginning of what we know as Parshat Etchanan, that portion. Vayetchanan el Hashem, and I begged God, I beseeched God at that moment, saying, and then what follows is Moses remembering how he prayed to God in certain terms. What we know up to now is the tone in which he prays. Vayetchanan gives us the tone, and I beseeched God, I begged God. Lashon Trina. Question of, this is what really one of the essential tones of prayer, that one is begging God with a passion and with a desire. And I'll just read through what Moses says till we get to the central point very quickly. Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your strong hand. You have begun to show him. So now, e'ebrana ve'ere et aris hatova. Please let me cross over and let me see that good land, which is on the other side of the Jordan, Be'ever HaYarden. Now that's the essence of his prayer. E'ebrana, let me cross over. There is the word la'avor, aleph beit resh, to cross over from one side to the other of the Jordan. That's what he's really asking for. He doesn't use, for instance, the expression that is used all through the book of Numbers, the previous book, when it comes to completing the journey, finishing the journey of the people in the desert and ending up in the land of Israel. The expression is la'alot, to go up to the land. People want to go up, they don't want to go up. Now the question is not going up. Here they are right on the banks of the Jordan. And now the question is, are we going to get over that river or not? There's a barrier of some kind here. And Moses knows that he has been condemned not to cross over. And now he begs God, please let me cross over and see that good land, which is on the other side of the Jordan. And then mysteriously, Moses reports, this is part of his speech to the people. Moses reports, Vayit aber Hashem bi lemanchem, and God was furious with me. It's a very strong word for anger. God was extremely angry with me because of you, he says to the people. Very mysterious. What do you have to do with the fact that God is punishing me for something? And the word to be angry also has in it that root, Aleph Beit Resh, Vayitaber. God was, as it were, he was filled with anger. He swelled up with anger. Very, very dramatic and very, I would say, violent, really. Velo shama elai, and he didn't listen to me. And I think that's almost the most poignant part of the story. Because here is Moses, to whom God has always listened in the past. Moses has had an excellent relationship with God. Whenever the people are in trouble, God listens to Moses. Moses is the intercessory. That's what he was appointed to be from the very beginning. And Moses' relation to God has never been the problem. The problem has always been, if you are an intermediary, right? If you stand between God and the people, then you have to talk to both sides. And the side that Moses has more trouble with is the human side, talking to his people. And from the beginning, from the burning bush, you may remember, when God calls Moses to the mission, of his life, to take the people out of Egypt and to bring them into the Holy Land. From the beginning, Moses protested and tried to shuffle off the commission, saying basically, what does he say? I'm heavy of speech, heavy of tongue, kvad peh u kvad lashon. These are the classic expressions. I can't speak, and therefore I can't speak to the people. I can't carry your message to the people. And he pleads somewhere an incapacity with language in many different ways. He also says simply, lo ish devarim anochi, I'm not a man of words. I'm not a man of words. He also says, and this is the most dramatic, I think, and imaginative way of putting his problem. He says, aral sfatayim, I am of uncircumcised lips, which somehow seems to suggest a kind of weight in his lips. He has a foreskin hanging on his lips, joining his lips together so that he can't actually separate them and he can't articulate. Now that, of course, is a surrealistic image. To give one the feeling, it seems to me, when he says it like that, it gives one the feeling, the most intimate feeling, of what it's like to be Moses. What it's like to be in Moses' mouth, how Moses senses what's going on in his mouth, as if his lips are sewn together in some way. But it's clear that that problem that he has, which God again is angry, at that point also God is angry with Moses for not wanting to take up the commission. The problem is one of speaking to the people. That always was the problem. There never was a problem in speaking to God. It came to God, but Moses basically had a wonderful time. Every time he went up the mountain, he would be having, this was the communion of his life. Clearly, that's when he felt most comfortable. At one point, people doubt that he's ever going to come back to them. And the reason that he might not come back, perhaps, is that they sense that he's all too comfortable up there, and that he's in bliss up there at the top of the mountain. So that God has to say to him more than once, Lech Red, get on down there. You have to be with the people, not with me. I don't need you up here. What do I need your greatness for? The Midrash has a very scathing commentary on that, those words, get on down there. I know you're enjoying being up here. Up here is wonderful, but you need to be down there. And God uses that expression, of course, when he tells Moses about the golden calf, about what the people have been doing down there. And says to him, don't stay another minute longer here. You are needed down there. Now, after that whole history about language and about the capacity to speak and be heard, which Moses is so dubious about in his relation to the people, now it turns out, I come back to the prayer, now it turns out that Moses tells the people, God would not listen to me. Now, God is not listening to me. And how do I know he was not listening to me? It's absolutely a feeling of being slighted in some way. God wouldn't even listen to me. And God said to me, Ravlech, stop right there. That's quite enough. God actually interrupts Moses in his prayer. He doesn't let him have his say. Al tosef daber elai od badavar hazeh. Don't go on talking to me anymore about this matter. I don't want to hear another word from you on this matter. Now, that is very harsh language from God to Moses, who has such an intimate relationship with him. And I think I have friends who cry every year when this is read in the synagogue. They somehow feel this moment in its poignancy very deeply. I do too. I don't always cry, but it's an extraordinary moment of Moses rejected, repudiated. I don't want to hear another word from you about this matter. Go up to the top of the mountain, look north, south, east, and west. You can see it with your eyes. Ki lo ta'avor et ha-yarden hazeh. But you will not cross over this Jordan River. You will not cross over. Moses had said, Ebrana, please let me cross over. And God's answer, first of all, is, I don't want to hear anymore. Stop talking. This is after God has spent all Moses' life persuading him to talk. And now he says, I don't want to hear another word from you. And then he says, you wanted to see the land? Okay, you can see the land, but you will not cross over. In other words, you can see it from a distance. You can see it absent. You can see it as something you have not achieved. Now, this very harsh speech of God, this is surely the most difficult moment of Moses' life, because this is the relationship that is closest to his heart. And at this moment, what does Moses choose to do? Not exactly this moment, later at the end of his life, when this prayer happened, we don't exactly know, because there is no objective record. There's no account in the whole of the Torah of such a scene of rejected prayer, except for the fact that Moses chooses to tell the people about it. And that's the main question that I'm haunted by. Having had such a humiliating and painful moment with God, why is it that Moses then turns around and tells the people about it? Who is supposed to gain from this confidential, from this, in a way, this report of a confidential conversation between Moses and God, which is so painful for Moses? What does Moses hope to get from the people if he tells them about this scene? And I find that to be, it's a question that is basically not really answered fully and clearly by any source that I know. There are various suggestions, and I'm going to be working on the basis of one such suggestion. But I think we need a certain ability to enter into the words of the text, not just to hear them, but to enter into them. Particularly that word, la'avor, to cross over. That's our theme word for this evening. It doesn't sound so interesting. You know, we cross the road, we cross a river. Its basic meanings are pretty simple, but even the basic meaning, it means in some way leaving where you are and going somewhere else. Going somewhere that is actually barred from you in some way. I want to be suggesting that it's a word that expresses the erotic. It's a rather unexpected word, perhaps, to use. It's a word that expresses that which I would like to be able to hold, and I'm prepared to leave wherever I am in order to go there, to cross over. And then the question is, will I be able to do that? The very nature of eros, the very nature of desire, may prohibit my ever being able to complete my human life. That there's something in the nature of desire that flourishes when the object of desire is absent. Yeah. When are we most alive with desire? When we don't have what we want. But once we have it, you know, I'm putting it in very down-to-earth terms here, once we have it, it changes. Let's say it passes into a different phase. The pure eros is no longer there. And what we have here, therefore, is a sense that for Moses, that movement is the movement of his whole life, the movement from wherever you are to something else. God says to him, you will not be doing any more crossing over now. This is where you finish, here on this side of the Jordan. Joshua, on the other hand, he will replace you and he will cross over. That's what God reveals to Moses now in the next sentence. Joshua will be the leader, and how will we know he's the leader? In the context of this prayer, we will know because he will do the crossing over. That act will become his. That's the act of human life. But your life ends here. Now, I can't help remembering the story of the 2.5 tribes. You remember Reuben, Gad, and the half the tribe of Manasseh at the end of the book of Numbers, who didn't want to cross over. And they came and they appealed to Moses, please let us stay on this side of the river because the land is very fertile and we have a lot of cattle and this is perfect grazing land for our cattle. And Moses is very angry with them. Perhaps he misunderstands them. I don't want to go into all the details. I'm making a very simple suggestion. The 2.5 tribes are so passionate about wanting to stay here and not go there that they actually use the expression, "Al ta'avirenu et ha'yarden," as it. Please don't make us cross over this river. And I can't help hearing this through Moses' ears. What must it have felt like for Moses, whose greatest desire is to cross over? Ebrana, please let me cross over. To hear these people who can cross over, denying themselves the opportunity of crossing over and saying, actually, no, we'd rather not. Please let us off this. All right? It's a kind of lo'eg larash, you know, as we say in Hebrew. It means it's a kind of, for Moses, it's a provocation. How can you? Where is your desire? Right? There's always been a lack of desire that he senses in the people, that they haven't wanted enough to enter into the land. Lo avitem la'alot. You didn't want to go up in the book of Numbers. And now they're doing it again. They did it once with the spies, and now these 2.5 tribes are doing it again. And Moses is pretty exasperated, perhaps, at this. One more point, perhaps, about the question of the prayer. The Torah doesn't tell us that Moses prayed to God and that God repudiated him. What it does tell us is that Moses told the people, this was part of the account in the book of Deuteronomy, that Moses gave of the years in the desert, particularly this last period. And again, I come back to my question, why did Moses choose to tell the people such a story? What is he hoping to gain? And I can't help remembering again that Rashi says, for instance, if you want to know when that prayer was, we have no clue when that prayer actually happened, because it's never hinted at in the actual narrative. We only know it from Moses' account to the people. One suggestion is that maybe it was at the end of the book of Numbers, chapter 27, after God had agreed to let women inherit their father's property, the story of the daughters of Tzlofchad, you may remember. It was a very hard point to gain, and these five daughters do gain their point. And perhaps after that, Moses sees that God is open, perhaps, to protests. He's open to people claiming what they think they should have. And he thinks, this is my moment for the prayer. And he chooses that moment to pray. And then what we read, we don't read anything about the prayer in that context. But what we do read is that God says to Moses out of the blue, "Ale el har ha'avarim hazeh." Please climb up to the top of this mountain of crossings over. That's the name of the mountain. Suddenly, it's a mountain of crossings, and look north, south, east, and west, because that's as much as you'll be able to achieve. Now, that sounds very similar to what we have here, and so there is the speculation that perhaps that was when he prayed. If so, there is something extremely interesting that follows. What we have is Moses turning to God, perhaps after this prayer and after this repudiation by God, turning to God, and what we read is Vayidaber Moshe El Hashem. And Moses then spoke to God, saying, who is going to be looking after the people? He is the one who elicits from God who is going to take over the leadership. The interesting thing, though, is not what he says, but how he says it. Vayidaber. Vayidaber is a very strong form of language. It's not Vayomer. He said, right? That's a soft saying. Vayidaber is always taken traditionally as meaning a kind of harsh speech, a speech of leadership, of demand, of making clear what you want. How often has Moses ever addressed God under that tone of Vayidaber? It's a certain tone. How many times do you think Moses ever spoke in that tone? Well, you might guess what I'm going to say. Never. That is, this is the first time that Moses had ever spoken to God under the rubric of Vayidaber. That means, and the Midrash actually says it, Ki'ilu ba bizroa, as if he suddenly comes with extra force. Suddenly he speaks to God with unprecedented force. When? Just at the moment of failure, you might say. Just at the moment when God has said to him, stop talking, I don't want to hear another word about it. No. At the moment of repudiation, how does Moses react? There is some strange, what can I say, some inner move, some psychic move in himself. Freud perhaps called it sublimation. That is, somehow that moment of failure gets translated very fast into a moment of strength vis-a-vis God. If that's the truth, then I will now turn to a different desire. I see you're not giving me this desire, but perhaps what you are hinting to me, and this is the way Moses now reads God's, what the very difficult speech that God made to him. Al tosif daber elai od badaver hazeh. Don't speak to me any further about this matter. Perhaps the way Moses now hears it is, don't speak to me about it, go speak to the people about it. Which on the face of it is a rather strange idea. Moses realizes that in a way, the drama is no longer between himself and God. That he and that is by now he's achieved everything that he can achieve in his relationship with God. And it's been no slight achievement. Now he has to go and do something with the people. That in a way is unfinished business. And what I want to do now is to look very briefly with you at a Hasidic passage and two Midrashic passages, which sketch in a background for this idea that Moses' business now is with the people, that he has to turn and actually tell them something that you might have thought was entirely private after God has repudiated him. If you have a look at your source page, if you have it, all right, number four, the Me'a Shiloach, 19th century Hasidic group, powerhouse, says this. He relates here to the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy when Moses says to the people, bring for yourselves people who are wise and understanding and distinguished. Chachamim u'nevonim v'yiduim, because I can no longer lead you alone. How can I go on leading you alone? And the comment of the Me'a Shiloach is, and I'm just going to say it very, very quickly, very, very simply. His comment is that Moses now knows at this point of the story that he's not going to lead the people into the land of Israel. And he's now saying to the people, I can't go on being your leader without your help. That is, I can't lead you alone doesn't mean just what it seems to mean, that I need a whole hierarchical system, bureaucratic support system, but I need your help if I am to continue to lead you across the Jordan. And he is hoping that they will pray for him, li'yavakshu rachamim, that they will ask for mercy for him, that they will pray for him, because I can no longer lead you alone. And what he really wanted was that the people should pray to God that they don't want any other leader. That is, it's a moment in which Moses is expressing his desire that they should desire him. That is, it's a very delicate moment in which he is angling, without being able to say it directly, please pray for me, it might help. Now, he can't say it directly, I think for obvious reasons. Because if you want someone to desire you, you desire someone, and you want them to desire you, then you can't say directly, please desire me. Please show that right? It simply doesn't work like that. You have to engage in a kind of courtship of some kind. You have to do something that's not explicit and blatant. And that's what he was trying to do, and he hoped they would understand, but they didn't understand. Now, that's the story that the Me'er Shiloach tells, the Ishbitzer tells, that Moses is here hinting to them by saying, I can't lead you alone. He is saying without saying, please intervene for me. And he thinks they'll get it if they're in any way sensitive to his inner world, and they don't get it. In a sense, they complete their lifetime of not listening to Moses. Right? It began at the beginning, and it goes on somewhere throughout the whole story, that they don't quite get Moses, neither when he conveys God's will, nor here in this final scene in which he tries to convey obliquely his own passion, his own desire, what he wants of them as a relational matter, as something that I want you to want. You know, these are things that can't be put into words so blatantly. So when I first came across this passage, I was very excited about it because it seemed to me a very subtle and profound way of talking about a moment of failure between Moses and the people. And then the question arising, what would happen as a result of this? Is this a failure that Moses leaves the scene with? And then I wondered, where does he get this idea from? Is it entirely his own invention? And then it turns out there is good ancient midrashic backup for this idea. And I'm going to stay on the source page now, looking at number 5 on the source page. And here, paraphrase and translate. When they came to cross the Jordan, Moses remembered, he reminded the people of how often he had defended them and asked for them to be forgiven in their trouble. And he hoped that they would do the same for him. What does it mean, therefore, when he keeps saying, Ata over, you are crossing over the river. He keeps on, that's a motif throughout the book of Deuteronomy. You are crossing over the river. I am not crossing over, right? That's the, you are crossing over. I am not crossing over. What does he mean when he says that? Patach lahem petach. Patach lahem petach. He was opening an opening for them. He was hinting to them. He was half opening a door, not entirely saying it. What he was hinting to them is, you're crossing over. I'm not crossing over. Right? If you say that with a certain tone, it's all a matter of tone, then perhaps the other person would get it. You know, that maybe I could help him to cross over if I really want. But they don't get it. Velo hevino. What is this like? And follows a parable. And it's a very fraught parable. We could easily spend a lot of time on this, but we don't have a lot of time. It's like an aristocratic lady whose husband wanted to divorce her. She had in some way displeased him. And he said to her, do you know that I'm taking another wife? And she said to him, yes, but are you not going to tell me who she is? And he gives her the name of the future wife. What did this lady do? She didn't try to argue with her husband. She went to her children, to her many children. And she said to them, yeah, here, Amaralahem. She said to her children, do you know that your father is seeking to divorce me and to take another wife? Can you bear to be submitted to her? It's like, that's a hint. Can you bear to have a stepmother? Right? Can you bear to have, you know, a mother who is not really your mother? And they answered her, and this is the shock of the whole midrash. Hen, just one word. Yes. In other words, they apparently are blithely unaware of, in any sense, of her tragedy, of what she needs, that she needs some kind of help from them, perhaps if you go to your father and intervene. But obviously, that's what she's trying to suggest to them. And they say blithely, oh, yes, that's just fine. They're perfectly calm about it. And then she tries to press it a little bit, to hint, to strengthen the hint. But do you know that your father wants to, I'm sorry, next line here. She says, do you know how she might behave to you? After all, she's a stepmother. She won't intervene every time you get into trouble with your father. And they still, and she says it in that way, perhaps they will understand and they will intercede with their father. And they didn't understand. They didn't get it. Mavinin. And the Midrash goes on to say, and it's a very, very powerful ending, that the mother then says to the children, I'm worried to you. I was worried for myself up to now. I wanted you to help me with my situation. But now I am worried for you. If you don't understand what not having me around will mean, that actually you will have lost, you know, one of your, what made it possible to live in this triangle between with God and the people, like a angry father and difficult children. And if you have your mother there, then that helps the triangle to work. If this corner of the triangle is missing, then you better watch out. And now I'm worried for you, she says. I'm really worried for you because you have so little capacity, it seems, to understand, to get it, to be able to take a hint. It's what we now call perhaps emotional intelligence. You may be very intelligent in all kinds of ways, but you are not quick to take the hint. You're not the quick to cross over between yourselves and the person who's talking to you. Somehow to try in some way to bridge the distance, even if incompletely, between one person's desire and the other person's desire, a relationship of that kind. And the wife is quite lugubrious about the prospects for her children, and Moses is lugubrious about the prospects for his children. The Me'a Sheloach actually added there at the end of number four that in that context where the people were told to appoint wise men and understanding people, Nevonim and Yiduim, three kinds of intelligence, in the end only wise and distinguished people were appointed. And the Nevonim, there was no Nevonim, there were no understanding people, to which the sages say in the Midrash that there's no understanding people because Moses couldn't find any understanding in the people at this point. On this personal issue of Moses himself, he realized that there's no one actually who has that quality of intuition, of knowing how to go to the place that's not in your hand, to go towards something that is somewhere remote from you. Which makes me think that in a way, that's what we're all trying to do now. We're trying to bridge an impassable gap, moved by some kind of desire. Okay, I'm full of desire here, so I'm going to move on now to number six. Number six expands on the same idea. What do we have here? God says to Moses, you wanted two things and you can't have them both. When the people sinned with the golden calf, perhaps you can follow in the English, when the people sinned with the golden calf in number six, when the people sinned with the golden calf, you begged for them. After God had said, just let me alone and I'll destroy them. Then Moses had begged for them that they should be forgiven. Slachna, he had begged, please forgive them. And God had said, Salachti kedvarecha, I have forgiven. So I listened to you on that one. But then it came to your own business, to your own fate. And there I said, you will not cross over. And you said, please let me cross over. And I said, no, you will not cross over. Why? Because you can't have them both. If you want one, you can't have the other. Choose between them. And I wonder why you can't have them both. Why can't you have a desire for the people, that you care for the people, and you also care for yourself? Why can't I have the satisfaction of both of my desires? The expression that's used in the Midrash is, has God chiding Moses and saying to him, Moses, you don't know what to do. You don't know proper behavior, proper etiquette in these situations. You want to hold the rope at both ends. That's the image. You want to hold the rope at both ends. You can only have one end. You can hold only one end of the rope. Choose. And then the point of the Midrash obviously is that Moses, if you put it that way, Moses, without any further thought, unhesitatingly chooses for the people. And he says, you know, let a hundred Moseses die. Right? So it's almost a comic cry at the end of the Midrash. Let a hundred Moseses like me die, but not one nail on their hands be injured. Right? Of course, there's no choice. If it's between me and them, my personal fate and theirs, then there's no question at all. That's the point of the Midrash. But Moses here, what is Moses doing in this Midrash? If we go to the end there of number six, when Moses was about to die and they didn't ask for compassion for him, right? They didn't in any way move themselves to help him when he had helped them so much. He used this expression. He rebuked them, mochichan. He began to rebuke them. And he said to them, one person could redeem 600,000 when it came to the golden calf. But 600,000 couldn't redeem one man in my case. You didn't manage, all of you together, to recognize an opportunity to help me. And I seized on the opportunity to help you. So on the one hand, what we get from this is Moses' absolute devotion to his people. No question about it when it comes to a choice. And on the other hand, the notion that Moses reflects about it. That Moses has a certain bitterness about it. That this is not something that he simply, it's not just an unthinking leap into the abyss. You know, I don't care what happens to me. It's that he thinks about the relationship. How come I'm prepared to do everything for you and you can do nothing for me with all your combined forces? And what is problematic for him is their inability to take a hint. What's the proof text of this Midrash? It takes us to the end of Sefer Devarim, right at the end of the book, where we read one of the last things Moses says to the people, V'lo natan lachem lev ladat, and God didn't give you a heart to know, and eyes to see, and ears to hear until this very day. What is Moses speaking about when he reproaches the people at the end of his life? Right? Almost the last thing he says. He reproaches them and says, you somehow have been insensate. Yes, your senses have failed you. Somehow your emotional senses. You didn't have eyes and ears and a heart until this day. And this Midrash understands this not just as a general statement, a general reproach to the people for their rebellions and their obstinacies in the wilderness, but as a personal reproach from Moses to a people who couldn't hear him, even at this last moment. The pathos of that moment, God didn't give you. Right? You are unaccountably obtuse. What does Moses do about this? Now, we have just a few minutes to try to include a great deal. It seems to me that what Moses is doing in this last moment of his life, these are the last months of his life when he tells the people about his repudiation by God, is that in some way he's staging for them. Let me add another sentence first. That he has decided that the goal of his desire can no longer be to reach the land of Israel. God has made that very clear, that is out of the question. And so he sublimates that desire. That's one way of putting it. He exchanges that desire. He transforms it for the desire for the people. That the people, to do something for the people before he leaves them. What most needs doing? What he wants to do is reach out across the gap, not the River Jordan in this case, but across the gap between himself and the people. And reaching out across that gap would mean, in some way, first of all, making them aware of how lacking in imagination and intuition they are. That is, in some way, making them aware of their blind spot. It's only when you become aware of your blind spot that you perhaps can begin to do something about it. You know, even then, it's not so perfect what you can do about it. A blind spot tends to remain somewhere. Can't be changed. But nevertheless, once you have an awareness, you have an insight into your own lack of insight, right? That already is a beginning. And how does he do this, right? The idea of the object of his desire is no longer Eretz Yisrael, right? He has sacrificed that. And instead, he comes with a strong arm. He speaks powerfully. He speaks powerfully to God, to whom he has never spoken in this way before, and talks about the continuity of the people, the future leader, and so on. And he now speaks powerfully to the people too. And what is the way that he speaks powerfully? What is it that he is doing here? He's deploying here all the weakness and the strength of desire. The weakness that says that, after all, it's something that it involves a kind of shift of position. You know, somewhere I have to find a way in which to address you. I have to move out of my present position and to move somewhere else. That's what it means to be over. The way I have been with you all your lives, all my life, transmitting God's word with that kind of authority, that no longer is how I'm going to speak to you. In this scene, I'm going to speak to you, staging my own distress, putting in front of you my own distress, my anguish at having God refuse my desire, and the process that I have to go through in order in some way to come to terms with that. What Moses is trying to do in these last speeches to the people, and particularly at moments like this, when he's putting on record in front of the people how God refused him in his heart's desire, he's presenting for the people a certain sense of the truth of himself. There's nothing like displaying oneself in one's weakness, in one's vulnerability, in one's agitation. There's nothing like that for letting other people see you, see who you really are. In a way, he drops a certain mask, which is the mask of his spiritual connection with God. And now he is there as a human being in front of the people, speaking about disappointment and envy and annoyance with the people. Somewhere all that is implicit in his speech. Perhaps this has something to do with Moses, our teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu. When does Moses become, in the classic expression, Moses, our teacher? At exactly what moment in the story does he become Moses, the teacher? And I'm suggesting that that this is the moment. That is, that when he taught them all the laws from Mount Sinai and from other audiences with God, certainly he was conveying revelation to the people. But the idea of really being Moses, our teacher, really comes from this moment. Because this is the moment when Moses stands in front of his class, right? He stands in front of the people like a teacher. And the position, perhaps, of a teacher in front of a class, a French philosopher, Roland Barthes, makes this suggestion, that the position of a teacher in front of a class, talking away in front of a class, and the class listening and not saying anything, and listening to the teacher's unknown knowledge of himself, listening to the teacher giving himself away, in a sense. That is like the role of the patient in a psychoanalysis. That's a very strange analogy. That it's not that the teacher is not the analyst. The teacher is actually in the role of the patient, the analyzand, who spends his time, her time, talking and talking and talking, while the analyst listens silently and takes note of all the things that the patient doesn't realize he's saying. That is, all the things that you'd have to read the Midrash to find out about, you know, that when Moses was really feeling at this moment. In other words, coming to conclusions, the class is learning much more than the content of what the teacher is saying. The class is learning how the teacher learns, how the teacher processes difficult things intellectually. The teacher is teaching how to learn, the questions the teacher asks, and perhaps more importantly, how the teacher, the posture of the teacher in trying to face this situation of transmitting to a new generation, transmitting to others, crossing over the gap between the teacher and the student, and the difficulty and the struggle that's involved in that. And Moses hopes, and perhaps it's true, it seems to me, Moses hopes that the people will get something at this point, that they will understand something of Moses' process, and they will take it personally. That is, they will begin to understand that one always begins to learn out of ignorance, that one starts from a place somewhere of failure. One starts from something goes wrong, I can't do it, in one sense or another. But hopefully what happens then is that from the ignorance, I begin to see how one deals with that ignorance, how one begins to try to bridge the gap, perhaps on the basis of that passion for ignorance that people seem to be doomed to have. Freud said there are three impossible professions, and one of them is education, trying to teach people. And Moses teaches the people, perhaps this is his teaching moment. This is his most pedagogical moment as he tells the people about his own failure. In the end, and I'll just add one more quick point before opening this up. When Moses goes up the mountain and looks north, south, east, and west, God makes a last speech to him and says to him, I have shown you with your eyes, the land, v'shama lo ta'avor. I've shown you the land, but you shall not cross over there. And in the light of what we've been saying, I had to gasp when I read those words. Why does God rub it in at the end? Why does God say this unnecessary thing to Moses? It's clear, surely, that he's not crossing over and that God has shown him the land, right? All this is a fact. Why does God have to let that be the last sentence that Moses hears from God? And what I'd like to suggest by way of finishing is perhaps that God is emphasizing the shama. It's a question of tone, it's a question of emphasis. There you shall not cross over. Your life of desire will not culminate in the literal fulfillment of your desire, the concrete fulfillment of your desire. But other gaps you have crossed over. Your people, perhaps that's what Moses meant when he said, God has not given you eyes or ears or a heart until this day. Right? Depends how you read it. Does he mean till now and you're still blind and deaf and heartless? Or does he mean actually, suddenly today, you seem to have got it. Somehow, as a result of how I've been speaking to you, you're beginning to open up. You're beginning to open the possibilities of making more of things than can be clearly written in the words. That is, of understanding what can't be put clearly into words. That's what we call the oral law for the future. And that's what, hopefully, in that sense, Moses dies knowing that he has made that crossing, that perhaps most important crossing over to his people, in that sublimated, powerful gesture of his speech of vulnerability. If we go back now to the... How do I go back?
Ah, here okay. You. Oh. We're here. A big virtual applause in Yasher Koach, Dr. Zornberg. Thank you so much. I've moved the screen share, so it's just you. But if you need the screen share again, then by all means, we will turn to you. We have approximately 10 minutes right now, and I have a series of questions that have been submitted by the participants, and as well as an invitation to anyone who would like to share any further questions. Dr. Zornberg, if I could begin, when we are speaking about unfinished lives, one of the richest veins I found of your magnificent book was the biographical intergenerational elements of Moses' life. The degree to which he received, in a very complicated way, nature and nurture from those who preceded him, as well as the cold fact that his legacy would not be through his own children. And chapter 4 deals with Aaron and Miriam. So I'm wondering if you could speak about this notion of unfinished life through the generations as it shaped Moses' sense of self.
Well, you put it very beautifully. I don't know if I do it as clearly as that in my book. I think what I'm thinking of when I hear what you just said is the fact that Moses is born, first of all, of a people fated to genocide. And his personal fate of being put in the river by his mother is, in a way, an acceptance of that as a fact of his life. That is, the trauma of his life will never be obliterated, and that is that his mother actually has to do what Pharaoh decrees. She puts him in the river. And three women save him from the river, so that he has a kind of triple birth into the world, you could almost say. He's born biologically, and his mother then acts on that maternal feeling and sees how beautiful he is, how tall he is, the house is full of light. That is, she connects then on a spiritual level with what he is capable of. And then she puts him into the river with a well-upholstered box. That's one birth-death. And then the sister, Miriam, waits by the river and waits to see what will happen. She knows that something will happen, that this is a death that will have a resurrection, that there will be, but she waits to see in what form that will come. So she hangs around there at a distance from the river and at a distance from her family, according to a poignant midrash, that her family in some way have rejected her for insisting that the parents get together again after they have separated. In other words, on multiple levels, Moses almost didn't make it into the world. And once he's made it, there he is out on the river, and then the princess, daughter of Pharaoh, comes and saves him and births him from the river, brings him back. There is the water motif again. He starts from water and he ends his life facing water, right, facing the river. But in this sense, the daughter of Pharaoh, the Egyptian, births him. And she is the one who names him. Now that's a complexity of identity. The complexity, of course, is underlined by the fact that it's not at all clear that he has continued connection with his biological family. People usually assume that he does have it, I have to say, in fairness. The tradition, I think, seems to assume that. But I think it's perfectly possible to read the text the other way, that Moses doesn't know on that first day he goes out to see the sufferings of his brothers. He doesn't know that these slaves are indeed his brothers. That's a moment of dramatic irony between the narrator and the reader. You know, and Moses himself doesn't really know. And they become his brothers, really, when he sees their suffering. That's what makes them his brothers. So there always is with Moses a sense that his connection with the past is both very vital and very distant, very remote, something like this. that God says to him, I'm the God of your father. That's almost the first thing God says to him. And we don't know how intimate a connection that is between Moses and his father. Does he really know his father? who does he think is his father? And that sense of exile and incompletion, well, that's Jewish history. That's very much Jewish history. And that is Moses as the outsider, now becoming the leader of the people, and the awkward relationship that then follows between himself and the people.
I'm going to try to jump in just so we get a few more questions here. I have a question from Ms. Rosenzweig, who's building on your comment you just concluded. The sense of incompleteness, which you mentioned, is also a sense of eros, of desire, which might also be a source of creativity, meaning without that incompleteness, if I'm reading her question correctly, then that, you know, that's actually the fuel that fuels us. And I was wondering, is that in sync with what your read of Moses, that without that incompleteness, he would not be who he is as leader?
Very much so. Yes. In that, I'm Freudian, if you want to put it like that. I'm thinking of Aristotle. All men, by their very nature, reach out to know. Now, reaching out means, again, reaching beyond your own capacity. Reaching out means going into the discomfort zone. And that is the creativity. That's what people do. They do it in love, in passion, and they do it in the desire, the passion to know. The passion to know and the passion to be creative. That's the dynamic.
Thank you. I think we might have time for one last question. I'll see what comes in. A Karen Frankel is asking about the reasons why Moses was not allowed into the land. Behind her question is, are we to assume that it was simply, or not so simply, striking the rock? Was that simply a hook to hang a hat on there, or was this God's plan all along? And how do we understand that moment and the disallowance from entering the land?
There clearly is a moment of failure at that scene with the rock, but whether it has to do with striking and not speaking, I think it's a very complicated question. I can't go into that in detail, but it does seem to me that this is one of those cases that the Midrash is courageous enough to recognize in many places, one of those cases where there is a moment in which there is a pretext for punishment, but in fact, somewhere all along, from the beginning of the story, in fact, the Midrash recognizes the idea that Moses will never enter the land. Right? It's something that Moses himself doesn't know, of course, but that is somewhere. And this is Kafka's perception. This is Kafka's understanding of human life. And in terms of his source of Jewish sources, particularly Hasidic sources, this is what constitutes the human being, that the human being has a crack in him, has a limit of some kind, an incompletion, something that doesn't quite work out. And that's what gives us a certain kind of syncopated energy, you know, an energy to do more than what's written.
Thank you. A last question from Beth Kisilev, who the opening of your book speaks of Moses being born into genocide. That question about how that connects to his end or his life story, if you could speak to that. The context of Moses' birth, the trauma of that environment.
I see that as very important, yes, that's the condition of his life. And in that, he stands for the people. In other words, there is his role as somehow a representative of the people. Moses is Israel in some real sense. But he stands for the purely private experience of trauma. A trauma not just as a national experience of the Jewish people, but basically as one, a very personal one, of the leader of the Jewish people. And in that sense, a question mark about what is meant by redemption. Moses has, what does it mean to be redeemed from trauma? There's no pat answer to that. I've looked for it, but I haven't found it. In other words, I've read a lot of books about trauma, and we all have our traumas. And it's not so simple to understand what is the exodus, Now, what is the Yetziat Mitzrayim? From traumatic beginnings, from traumatic origins.
Dr. Zornberg, I want to thank you for, I can't hold it, but it's, well, it's here, your book. Little we can see it. It is, I highly commend it to everyone on the call if you haven't read it, but this session with you has been extraordinary. It is always a treat to study Torah. It's always a treat to read what you write and what you teach. Longtime student, and we all are students of yours over the years, and certainly over this last hour, Tamar Bernstein, to Lindsay Rubin, thank you for making this all possible. Rebecca Keys, I know this isn't the circumstances we would have chosen, but I think the hundreds of people who are participating, maybe Jewish lives can find it in themselves as we're all sheltered in place. Maybe we can have more sessions with more authors of Jewish lives. Not that I should be telling you how to do your job, but we are all very much grateful to you, Rebecca, for your leadership in making this all possible. Most of all, to Dr. Zornberg and to all of your many students on this Zoom call, we thank you for joining us. We wish you health. We wish you safety to you and your loved ones. Have a good day, everyone. Thank you so much for participating.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.